Could the fossilized bones found in a cave in South Africa belong to a missing link in the chain of human evolution? Scientists have studied the fossilized skull, feet, hands, and other bones of an ancient hominid. They agree it's a fascinating find, but is it a human ancestor or an evolutionary dead end? Coming up, a conversation about human origins, and is it time to redraw the family tree? And what if the next time you got the flu, you felt the sudden urge to climb a tree? Sound crazy? It's happened in a caterpillar species. We'll tell you why. Plus, imagine an asteroid heading toward collision with the Earth. How would you deflect it? We'll talk to this year's winner of Move an Asteroid Competition. It's not science fiction anymore. Stay with us. No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine coming down with a bad case of the flu, but instead of feeling exhausted, you want to go climb a tree. Well, that's what happens if you're a gypsy moth caterpillar. When you're infected by a baculovirus, the caterpillars leave their hiding places. They climb for the treetops in broad daylight. And what happens next ain't very pretty. My guest has been studying virus-infected-insect interactions for years and has now found a viral gene that controls the behavior in the caterpillar and sends it climbing the tree. And she has just published her findings in the journal Science. Kelly Hoover is professor in the Department of Entomology and the Center for Chemical Ecology at Penn State University. Welcome back to Science Friday, Kelly.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you again.
What happens at the top of the tree there?
Well, infected caterpillars stay up there, and rather than climbing down during the day to hide from predators. And so the gene that this virus expresses, which is called EGT, causes them to stay in a feeding state by inactivating the hormone that causes them to molt. So normally when gypsy moths molt, or any insect molts, they stop feeding for quite a long period of time. And in the presence of this gene, the molt is blocked. And so the insect, instead of stopping feeding for a long time, keeps feeding and is therefore found up in the tree in the middle of the day when you normally wouldn't find them. So if you see a gypsy moth caterpillar out on leaves during the day, they're almost always infected.
But you didn't tell us what happens to the final, end of the caterpillar.
The poor thing ends up dying up there and is converted to a sack of virus that then melts or liquefies and rains virus particles down on the foliage below so that new hosts can be infected by eating the virus on the leaves.
Sounds like something out of Ghostbusters or something. You know,
it's pretty
slime.
It's very good.
It slimes the tree.
Yep.
But that's how the virus then spreads itself around.
Yeah. So it facilitates the virus being able to infect new hosts by having its sack of virus up at higher up in the tree so that when it rains down, it's able to hit the leaves and infect new hosts.
It sounds like it's a very cruel thing for a virus.
It is kind of cruel. I can't even think of a virus that infects mammals that does the same kind of thing in terms of turning the host into a bag of goo.
Wow. Well, so is it a special kind of gypsy moth, or is it every gypsy moth?
All gypsy moths are susceptible to this virus. It's a naturally occurring virus. You find it out in the field all the time. It's at low levels in the population until there's a population explosion. And then what can sometimes happen is the population will collapse because tons of insects get infected with this virus.
You know, we really don't like gypsy moths because they come and they take over the trees and eat the leaves and things, right?
Yep, and they can defoliate thousands of acres of forest so that it looks like, you know, winter when it's the middle of summer.
Doesn't this seem to when I'm thinking about it, I'm saying, hey, here's a gypsy moth, anti-gypsy moth thing. Could we not, you know, learn how to maybe genetically engineer this virus and get rid of the gypsy moths?
Well, we've been looking into that, actually. the gypsy moth does have an immune response to this virus, and it can fight it off if it's at the right age and if the dose isn't high enough, if it doesn't ingest enough virus to kill it. And so we've been looking into ways to suppress the immune system so that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. And normally gypsy moths would just climb to the top of the tree and molt up there?
Yeah, they'll molt, and then they'll feed on the leaves, but certainly at night they're out on the leaves. But during the day you'll see them, you know, in the morning they're climbing back down to hide in the bark crevices, or if they're bigger caterpillars, they'll go all the way down to the soil to hide.
You know, this sounds a little bit like rabies. You know, there are rabid raccoons and things that are supposed to be sleeping during the day, and they're out during the day, and you know they may be infected. This sounds something like that.
It certainly does, because you're right. What happens with rabies infection is that these animals will, as you said, they're nocturnal, but they'll be out at the wrong time. They'll be out during the day, and they get more aggressive. They'll approach, you know, another animal and try to bite them.
And do viruses, as you were intimating before, do you know other animals or that are affected, the behavior is affected by viruses?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. There are, there's quite a few viruses that can, and other parasites and pathogens that can manipulate behavior. But, you know, the thing that comes to mind that I think most people might be familiar with is toxoplasmosis, which is, it's not a virus, it's a protozoan. But you know how they say pregnant women shouldn't clean their litter boxes? They
Right.
should get somebody else to do it. And that's because they can pick this up from the litter box. Cats get infected with this, and they often will get it from mice that they eat. So mice infected with this lose their innate fear of cats, and they're more likely to get eaten. So their behavior does change. And it's even been speculated that people infected with toxoplasmosis, that their behavior can be altered as well. That's sort of, I would say, controversial, but it's certainly been suggested.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other viruses that might affect human behavior?
There might be, but I can't think of one that has similar types of effects on its host.
And so is that what you do? You study viral genes?
Yep, I do. I've been working on looking at different genes in this particular virus and how it interacts with the gypsy moth for quite a few years. And it's a pretty interesting system.
Let's get a question or two from our listeners. Derek in Grand Rapids. Hi, Derek.
Hi, how are you?
Hey there, how are you?
Good. Well, I'm just finishing up Origin of Species, so this evolutionary link kind of made me wonder how the virus evolved to manipulate the behavior of the insect. And isn't there there's one that affects the ants, too, where it climbs to the top of the grass?
Right, zombie ants infected with fungus, yeah.
Okay, right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just wondering how it actually evolved to get the behavior it wants.
Well, it's thought that this gene probably originated in an insect, because there are genes that are similar to this that are found in insects that have kind of a similar function, but they don't necessarily influence behavior. They do similar types of chemistry. But I would think what would happen is if you've got different strains of the same virus species, let's say, and one of them acquires this gene and it gives them an advantage, because it keeps your host from molting, it keeps it feeding, and also causes it to die in a position that allows you to enhance transmission to new victims, then you have a selective advantage. So that would be selected on and might then spread not only to within your own strain, but it could end up being a gene that you end up then seeing in other viruses as well. In fact, most baculoviruses have this gene. At least the ones that are in this group.
Right.
It perpetuates the virus.
It enhances the amount of virus you can get out of a given caterpillar, because by blocking it from molting and keeping it feeding, you get a bigger caterpillar, so you get more virus out of a given insect.
Derek mentioned the zombie ant. I can't let that pass without telling us about it.
Well, in fact, one of the co-authors on this paper, David Hughes, is the guy who works on zombie ants. And His work has shown that when ants are infected with this cordyceps fungus, that the fungus induces them to climb up the tree just to the right location, so the humidity and temperature is perfect for when the ant dies, the fungus not only starts growing out of the ant's head, which is really strange in time-lapse photography, but then it sporulates and rains spores down on unsuspecting ants below to infect them. The really cool thing as well is the fungus causes the ant's jaws to clamp down on a vein of a leaf. It's very hard to pry them loose. And that way you keep the ant in that location for a long time, because it takes the fungus several days, you know, to grow out and sporulate.
I'm thinking there's
pretty gross.
there's a screenwriter here listening, I'm sure.
Well, you know, I think it's really creepy for people to think about a parasite or pathogen could manipulate your behavior. It's a little creepy.
You didn't see The Tingler back years ago in the 50s where...
No, I guess I did.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah, yeah. But that's not real.
Oh, I forgot.
Yeah, but you could turn this... maybe that's how they got the idea, you know, looking at science.
Yeah, yeah. But so, as you say, you don't know of a whole lot of other viruses that might influence behavior or microbes, but they might be, and we may not know it. There might be other ones. You got to think we don't know all of them, right?
Right. And there are actually quite a few that are of different parasites and pathogens that do this. You know, there's this organism a pathogen, or I guess you'd call it a parasite, that infects snails and causes them to stay not only up on the leaves, but it causes their tentacles to pulsate and, like, advertise their presence to birds. So they can then get eaten by a bird and infect the bird. It's really a trip.
Well, if a bird eats this caterpillar with the virus, will it spread it that way?
Yes, it will, because the virus remains viable when it passes through predators like birds. So if they're out on the leaves in the day and they're advertising that they're there, the bird will eat them. And as they drop their droppings around on plants, that will spread the virus as well.
Well, that's got to get them before they turn to slime.
Exactly.
Yeah, well. Kelly, this has been delightful. Thank you it gives us something else to think about this weekend.
Well, you're very
something
welcome.
Different. Kelly Hoover is a professor in the Department of Entomology and the Center for Chemical Ecology at Penn State University. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A couple of years ago, a 9-year-old boy literally tripped and stumbled over something on the ground, and it turned out to be a collection of very significant fossil fragments in South Africa. He was and is the son of a well-known paleoanthropologist prospecting for potential dig sites, and so the find got immediate attention. And this week, the analysis of the bones from the hands, the feet, the pelvis, and other parts of the fossil find was published in the journal Science, and the scientists say that the find is unusually complete and well-dated, and it has the potential to really shake up the human evolutionary family tree. Joining me now to talk about what was found and what it might mean is Lee Berger. He is professor and reader in human evolution and the public understanding of science at the Institute for Human Evolution in the University of Witwatersrand, that's in Johannesburg, South Africa. And it was his son that made the initial find, and he's co-author on a number of papers this week in Science. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Well, thank you very much. My son always has me remind everyone that the dog was instrumental in the discovery as well.
What, you mean it was the dog that was, he was chasing the dog or something?
Absolutely, and said he tripped over the rock and saw the fossil sticking out of the side of it and then called me over. So we have to give Tao, the dog who is sitting right next to me here in the study, credit in the find as well.
You do? Has he got an asterisk in there or in the paper or something? Nothing in the footnote, though.
Absolutely.
Also with us is Bernard Wood. He is the GW University Professor of Human Origins and a Professor of Human Evolutionary Anatomy at George Washington University, and also an adjunct senior scientist at Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington. Welcome to the program.
It's very good to be with you both.
Thank you. Lee Berger, let me ask you first. You've called this a bona fide transitional species. That's pretty heavy, isn't it?
Well, and I'll tell you why. I think one of the reasons is because the find is so very complete. And I know extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, but I do think it's fair to say in this case where, you know, our field of paleoanthropology is often justifiably accused of being a science of fragments due to the nature of the fossil record, that these two skeletons are preserving areas of anatomy that really we haven't seen in this sort of condition before. In saying that, as we have analyzed in these five papers more extensively for critical areas of anatomy that are based on largely new material that's come out since we described the species last April, there are parts of it that do appear to tell a different story than the one we were interpreting from the fossil record we had before. Again, granted, the fossil record around this time period is incredibly small. It's based on literally just a few dozens of fossils and most of them incredibly fragmentary. Mm-hmm.
And so you found the complete parts instead of bone fragments scattered around a site. They were basically together so you could get a better idea of what some of the parts really were like instead of speculating on.
That's right. And there are many individuals coming from this site. The two that we're dealing with specifically are an adult female skeleton that is in articulation within the site, as well as a young male, probably around sort of 11 to 13 years of age in human developmental terms, that's also largely in articulation within the site. And that allows us to look at variation within these single skeletons, looking at proportions and looking at different parts of the anatomy. It also allowed us to compare between two individuals that are definitively from one species and one time range, and that in of itself is a special thing.
And you've called this Australopithecus adiba?
That's right. We named last April 2010 a new species, Australopithecus adiba, because the holistic anatomy of these, we were able to separate them from the fossil collections of known species, and in particular the most likely candidates, which would be the southern African species of hominids, Australopithecus africanus and Paranthropus robustus.
Mm-hmm. So where would this fit in the human lineage? If Lucy is 3.2 million years old, where would yours fit in there? And would it
we're
be
more than a million years younger than that? The date that we have published this week in Science, or in fact today in Science, is 1.977 million years plus or minus about 3,000 years, and so about 1.2 million years than the date you just cited, and we don't know where they fit in the family tree.
Yeah.
We put forward four possibilities in our papers. One is that this is a dead end, but if it's a dead end, it's one that shows many characters that we feel are associated with later members of the genus Homo, or it is an ancestral form of one of the several potential candidates of early Homo. People would know them as Homo habilis or Homo rudolphensis, or that it might be potentially considered as a direct ancestor of what is broadly considered as our immediate ancestor, Homo erectus. We put those forward ideas. One of the issues is that this fossil is in many ways so different, particularly in its postcrania, but also in parts of its craniodental and brain anatomy, that it doesn't necessarily tell the same kind of story that we had understood from previous discoveries. Again, one of the difficulties is that in this time period, largely from East Africa, there's a very poor fossil record in this time period from Southern Africa.
Dr. Wood, what's your reaction to this?
Well, my reaction is that that Lee, I think, has correctly emphasized the importance of the completeness of these skeletons. You know, if you use an analogy of a motor car, the difficulty if you have a lot of fragments is that, you know, you find a bit of a clutch and a bit of a brake pad and a bit of a steering wheel and a bit of the offside wing, but you because you've never seen the whole car, you don't know whether they all belong to the same car or not. The advantage of the completeness of these skeletons is that you can see what the combination of traits is in this creature. And although I don't think anybody would have correctly predicted this particular combination of traits, it's clear that, or at least it's clear to me that, you know, we are likely to find creatures with combinations of traits that we haven't yet seen before.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty about working out where this fits in the tree is that, you know, a few resemblances do not an ancestor make. And I think it's really difficult to identify creatures as ancestors. And I think this interesting organism, this interesting early hominin, to my mind, probably is not an ancestor of later Homo, because I think there's a bit too much evolution to do in very little time. But I can't be sure. It's just that my guess is that it's not. But that does this make this a less interesting discovery and these papers less significant? Not at all. I mean, you know, I think the combination of morphology which we see in Sidiba is one that we've not seen before, and that makes a whole lot of problems for reconstructing ancestry, because we can't be sure that this, you know, that you can't really specify a little bit of golden morphology that, you know, if the creature has this morphology, then it has to be ancestral.
Mm.
We're now finding that these morphologies, they occur in different early hominins in different combinations.
Well, let's talk about some of the unusual combinations of what the structure of the creature was. And one of the problems, I'll call it a problem just because I need a word, is that this creature had a smaller brain size, a smaller cranium than we would normally think in evolutionary process, right, Lee?
That's actually true. I think if you were going to put this as in the model that we had before Sidiba, that the way that encephalization or brain size increase had worked, he'd gone from very small brains that are slightly larger than chimpanzee brains in the 400 to 500 plus cubic centimeter range in early australopithecines like Lucy or Mrs. Plez. Things like that, and then there was a gradual increase in that brain size through some of the fossils that have been attributed largely younger than about 1.8 million years to things like Homo habilis or Homo rudolfensis as you move up into half our brain size and then three-quarters of our brain size and things like Homo erectus to us around 1,400 cubic centimeters to 1,600 cubic centimeters. At 2 million years, Sidiba sits with a 420 cubic centimeter brain, and that's right at the bottom of where we see australopithecines, only slightly larger even than the recent Flores hominids. And in fact, in an animal that's not that small, it's about 1.3 meters in size. But it's not the brain size that's important about Sidiba. What it appears from the synchrotron brain scan that we did, and Dr. Kristen Carlson led this part of our study, is that there appear to be more derived features in parts of the brain, and maybe even some incipient, without being too basic, bumps and swirls that might indicate areas like Broca's area potentially enlarging. We pointed to these and said that in fact, if you look at the overall, particularly the shape of the anterior aspect of the brain behind the eyes, that these areas mirrored more the homo-like condition. And I think it's important, and I think that probably Bernard would agree with me on this, it's important to understand when we say the homo-like condition to possibly sort of exclude from the discussion for a moment things like homo habilis and Rudolphensis, but talk about later homo, things that we would more generally agree are definitively in the genus, things like Homo erectus and Homo sapiens and Neanderthals.
Well, that's your argument, is that you believe it is possibly a direct lineage to humans, to Homo sapiens.
Well, what the basic argument is that when you go from the head down, you look at things like the hand, which we published, which is the most derived hand that's been discovered. It's more derived in many ways towards that later Homo condition than things like the hand, in fact, forms part of the type description of Homo habilis, and the pelvis is more like what we see, the pelvis of a later derived Homo erectus, Homo sapiens, Neanderthals, than any other Australopithecine pelvis. We don't have any pelvises definitively of any of those early, quote-unquote, early Homo in the middle. Then when you add those things up in the very small teeth, which are, in fact, in the range of human variation and other features, we say that, well, at least Sediba must be considered as a potential ancestor in that lineage. We're not saying it is. We say it deserves consideration, and it does so in a surprisingly different way than the way we were hypothesizing with those early Homo candidates, Habilis and Rudolphensis. Mm.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Lee Berger and with Bernard Wood. Dr. Wood, you're saying let's wait a little bit more. Do we need to find new fossils that match this one?
It would be nice, and I'm sure, and the jungle drums, they suggest that Lee already has, you know, they already have more material from
good jungle drums.
Malapa. And that will be, you know, that will be great. I mean, that, you know, we can only congratulate these people for recovering such excellent material. It's just that the combination of morphology that you see in Sediba, although...
Give me specifics.
Here and there you see sort of Homo-like like aspects. So, it's got a longish thumb, rather like ours, but that's matched with some rather ape-like things in its wrist. It's got some Homo-like aspects in the ankle region, but for every Homo-like feature, there is an ape-like feature to go with it. And so it's also clear that if you look elsewhere in the tree of life, that a lot of morphology does not just occur once in evolutionary history. It occurs several times. And if it occurs several times, and the technical word for that is homoplasic, if it occurs several times, it means that piece of morphology cannot be used as a proxy for saying something belongs to a particular lineage or not, because it occurs in more than one lineage. And the difficulty, it seems to me, is that a lot of the features that have been highlighted as maybe connecting this with Homo are likely to be homoplasic. And that means that it, sure, you know, it might be Homo, but it also might be something else.
Mm-hmm. Where we would diverge as a team with that opinion largely, or at least we would like to make a bigger point. We feel we're talking about areas that are very complex and are relatively unique. The hand is a complex area made up of a large number of bones that we would argue at 2 million years we're seeing what is something at least in the distal part of the hand around the fingers and the lengthening of thumb that is effectively undemonstrated in any other fossils. The same with the brain, and in fact with the pelvis. And one of the important things to remember is there almost is no other fossil record that can be definitively assigned to anything between 2.4 million and 1.7 million. There are some isolated bits and pieces. People will find an isolated pelvis, for example, and it'll look like a Homo pelvis. And they'll say, oh, this is a pelvis of Homo. But Sediba shows you can't take a pelvis like that and say, oh, it's Homo, because sediba has that same pelvis. You can take the isolate, if you took the mandible or the isolated teeth of sediba and found those individual teeth, you'd say, gosh, these are homo teeth. But they're not. They're in this package that Bernard did describe quite well, that a long-armed creature with a more human-like hand or with its remarkably ape-like heel. And the point we're making is that given the lack of a record, that now we do have something, and maybe that record was just misleading us. It doesn't mean it is. And we are, you know, we've been portrayed in the media, or particularly I have been portrayed in the media, as pushing this, as saying, this is the ancestor of Homo erectus. And I promise you that is more of a the press grabbing that statement. What I'm saying is that we now have a fossil that a well-represented series of fossils, not just little pieces, that says you can't use just little pieces to interpret the big picture anymore, right, and it has to be considered.
All right, we'll get back. We have a few more minutes to talk about it. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can tweet us at SciFry if you'd like to. We'll be back with Lee Berger and Bernard Wood after this break. Stay with us.
If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. We're talking this hour about history of the human, Homo sapiens, with this finding of Australopithecus sediba in South Africa, talking with Lee Berger from Johannesburg at the University of Witwatersrand, and with Bernard Wood, who is at the National Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian in Washington. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me ask you this question, Lee. You talked about narrowing down. You can pin down the date of this to a very narrow region, a few thousand years, in the middle of over a million-year-old fossil.
Yeah.
How are you able to do that?
It was really a lot of luck and a lot of hard work. We've had some major advances in dating fossils in southern Africa. It was our big bugbear for decades that we couldn't accurately date these fossils, and we had to use faunal dates, and so they had big errors. What happened a few years ago was the development of uranium-lead dating to date the flowstones. Flowstones are limestone layers that form within these caves, and you look at the decay of uranium within them that was reset as it formed. And at Malapa, we have a remarkable situation. We have a basal flowstone which underlies this deposit. The deposit formed very, very quickly, and literally within weeks, months. And then we found about 8 or 10 months ago a capping flowstone. Those flowstones were the same age, and they had relatively narrow error bars. And what happened, as the Malapa site formed, there was a paleomagnetic reversal. The Earth's poles reverse periodically in history, and it went from a normal polarity to a reverse polarity as that deposition happened. Well, there is only one event that fell within the overlapping error bars of those lower and upper dates, and that was a little event at 1.977 to 1.98 million years, and thus allowed us to tie this to a moment in time, effectively.
Let me try to wrap this up into some sort of lesson to be learned about this fossil find. And if I hear you saying correctly, Lee, you're saying that what this proves, beyond whether it's Australopithecus or Homo or whatever, is that you no longer, if you find a little piece of a hominid or a little piece of a fossil, you can no longer type it as easily as you might have thought you could, because your fossil shows there are pieces from all different kinds in that body.
I think that's a fair question. I don't want to say that, and I'm not saying that you can't use isolated remains to interpret function and form. I think we're going to have to be very careful, though, from the lesson of sediba in asking certain types of questions from isolated finds. No, I do not believe that you can take certain parts of the anatomy, like the pelvis, like the distal parts of the hand, like the mandible or isolated teeth, or things like the talus, even parts of the foot, and say, oh, this is definitively a member of the genus Homo, and vice versa, that you can't take bones and say, oh, this is necessarily an Australopithecine. And those type of questions, probably sediba says that they're not appropriate to those type of fossils. It may be true in other species, but this species says that's probably not wise to do. And if it's true in one species, it's probably true in others, as Bernard mentioned with homoplasy.
Bernard, what would it take to convince you that this is a transitional species?
It would take a lot more wisdom than I possess. It would take, you know, the problem is that sort of, you know, just because it's at the right, just because it's the right age, that doesn't make it an ancestor. And I'm, you know, for example, I'm probably old enough to be Lee's father, but I think he would agree that I'm not. So, you know, just being around at the right time is not enough. I think what, you know, what Sidiba has done is that it's reminded us that, you know, we have only seen just a few of the cards, and we are extremely tempted to come up with a comprehensive reconstruction of human evolutionary history on what is probably just a very small part of the evidence. And I think Sidiba has reminded us that, you know, that we shouldn't do this. You know, we should just, you know, lie back, you know, relax, make sure we analyze these fossils carefully, and then the truth will gradually emerge. And the truth being the reconstruction of the evolutionary history that at least the minority of us in the United States thinks happens.
I would add to that, I think the unspoken words that Bernard was not saying there, and by the way, I agree with everything you said, is we need to find more. We need to go out, explore more. What Sidiba also points out is there's more out there to find. Mm-hmm. Remember that this was recovered right in the middle of the most explored area, probably on the continent of Africa, for these very fossils lying on the surface so easy a 9-year-old could find it. And there, Africa's a big continent. It is unexplored. The rest of the world, it's a big place. And we need to get more exploration and find more fossils. And I think that is a clarion call that Sidiba rings out that I think Bernard was alluding to as well.
Well, does the fact that it was found in South Africa also throw something into the monkey wrench of general thought about evolution?
No.
No.
I would hope not, unless you're some sort of geographic xenophobia, but it, you know, I mean, there are biologists who would say, oh, well, certain types of evolution occur more on the periphery of continents than central, but we haven't explored this continent. I don't know. I would be fascinated to see what was living up in the mountain ranges along the edge of the Rift Valley and not just what you're picking up next to a lake. That's only a tiny representative of the life going on up there. And I can't wait till we see fossils out of Congo and out of West Africa and further north. And we will find those.
Better bring your kid along and the dog.
Oh, it is. It's a rule of mine now.
Is there enough money and resources to go looking in all these places?
Absolutely not. And what we need to literally pour money into is field exploration. There was, I think, a sort of ridiculous idea going around a decade or so ago that these fossil fields are depleting and that we found pretty much all the great fossil fields. Sidiba is a perfect example that is absolutely not true, and the funding agencies around the world should pour money into making these not the rarest sought-after objects on this planet.
Professor Wood, I'm sure you would agree with that.
Yes, I would agree with that, but I think, you know, there needs to be a healthy balance between discovering new evidence and making sure that you analyze the evidence that you discover in an appropriate way. You know, I mean, there's no point in having all analysis and no new fossils. There's not a lot of point in having a lorry load of new fossils if you don't analyze it properly.
Well, so the nice thing, though, I would say about having a lorry load of new fossils would be that we have all the time in the world to analyze them as long as we have enough of them.
Okay.
That's the only point I would make with that.
I'll take the lorry whenever it can come.
Try and deliver.
One other interesting aspect of this is that you mentioned in passing is that you scanned the fossil. You didn't even take it out of the rock it was in totally, did you?
That's in fact right. And in fact, that's a very deliberate thing, not only because technology now allows us to scan it at resolution that are truly unbelievable. We did it at the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility in Grenoble, France, scanned the skull at greater than 90 micron resolution. And we are, in fact, deliberately leaving parts of the skull in, as a record for future scientists. You know, if some of the great fossil finds, particularly from southern Africa, had been left with attaching matrix, things like the Tong Chau, Mrs. Pleas, we'd be able to date them today. Who knows what technology, at the pace it's changing, will allow us in the future. And that kind of activity is sort of part of our gift to future scientists a decade, 100 years, 1,000 years in the future.
Well, the fact that it's scanned, it's in a computer, it's a 3D model, can't people now with, you know, 3D printers just take that and make their own model of what you found?
That's exactly what we've done, and we're making that data available. We are allowing scientists to examine this material, published and unpublished, anything we find. Any bona fide scientist can come to our labs and examine whether we published it or not. So we're attempting an open access experiment. We've made casts available. You today could go over to the Smithsonian Museum or the American Museum of Natural History and see casts of the material that we published in Science today. They've been in those institutions for months and months and months, available to any scientist who wanted to look at them.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
Quite
if you could give your dog a pat on the head from me, Lee.
Oh, I will indeed. And thank you very much.
All right. Lee Berger is professor and reader in human evolution and a public understanding of science at the Institute for Human Evolution in the University of Witwatersrand, and that's in Johannesburg, South Africa. Bernard Wood, GW University Professor of Human Origins, Professor of Human Evolutionary Anatomy at GWU, and also at the Smithsonian National Museum in Washington. Next up, how to fend off a killer asteroid. Hollywood's been working on it for a while now.
Here's what we're going to do. I want every strategy we've got on near-Earth object collision, okay? Any ideas, any programs, anything you've sketched on a pizza box or a cocktail napkin? For 30 years, I questioned the need for NASA. Today, we're going to give them the answer.
And we're going to try to find a real answer to Billy Bob Thornton in that classic movie Armageddon. And blowing up an asteroid is not one of them. It's not such a good idea because you just create a whole bunch of new asteroids heading to the Earth to wreak damage and havoc there, too. Do you have a better idea? The Move On Asteroid Competition asked that question of students and young professionals. They were to submit their plan for dealing with an asteroid or another object that's on a collision course with Earth. And my guest is this year's winner of the competition, organized by the Space Generation Advisory Council. She really has an imaginative solution to the problem. Allison Gibbons is a PhD student at the Advanced Space Concept Lab at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
you found a way of creating, not blowing up, but creating and injecting a swarm of nanoparticles at it? Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, the concept's called Smart Allowed, and it's effectively a large cloud of small particles that are very low mass but high velocity. So think of it much like hundreds of thousands of marbles on a collision course with the asteroid. And each particle, in this case marble, would individually impact the asteroid, creating an impulse and subsequent change of momentum. And it's that sort of individual impulse which is acted on a cumulative and over a large time span would push the asteroid away from its sort of initially impacting trajectory and ultimately deviate it away from Earth. So that's the initial concept.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Allison Gibbons. So are these particles, is this cloud actually made of marble-sized objects, and are they intelligent, or are they computerized, or are they just pieces of stuff?
For the proposal, we actually considered each particle to be a small spacecraft on a chip approach. So if you think of hundreds and thousands of microgram pennies, basically, that's sort of the size. And they'd all fly in sort of relative formation to each other. They have a degree of sort of active control and operations so that they can kind of control their orientation in space. Mm. And then when they impact the asteroid, they kind of impact it en masse.
So you gently shove it with this cloud that engulfs it. Wow. And how practical is this? And how fast could we do this? Have you simulated this in the computer?
Yeah, the idea has been simulated and compared against other techniques out there, such as sort of kinematic impactors and low thrust tugs. And it it seems to be a feasible technique in terms of how much deflection and deflection rates you would get and how much you could effectively push the asteroid. In terms of the spacecraft on a chip approach to each of the particles within the cloud, that's based on technologies from the US at the University of Cornell. And the first sort of spacecraft on a chip approach to space satellite design and structured design is being tested sort of early next year. So it's based on kind of near-ish technologies.
Would these spacecraft on a chip, these tiny little chips, be communicating with each other?
They would know where each other are in space. They wouldn't actually communicate with each other directly, but they would be aware of each other. So they could kind of orientate themselves in a global sort of way.
So they could stay as a cloud?
Yeah, they could stay in a cloud and they could maintain their shape and sort of formation as they impact the asteroid, well, before impact.
So there would be a space vehicle that goes up close to the asteroid, releases this cloud of computers on a chip, and then would have to get out of the way itself so it doesn't impact the asteroid, right?
Yeah, ideally we would have initially the spacecraft that carries all these hundreds and thousands of small particle spacecraft would enter a collision course with the asteroid. It will then release this big swarm of clouds, and then it would veer off away from its sort of collision course so we can monitor the formation of the cloud and assess that the impact's been successful.
So what kind of reaction have you got people interested in building this?
Well, it's a new concept. It's going to be presented at the International Astronaut Congress and at the SGAC Congress. So it's got quite a lot of interest. The sort of the community of asteroid impacts and sort of mitigation technologies is fairly smallish, but it's growing. So we have a lot of interest, sort of internationally as well. So it is one of these sort of emerging areas.
How did you get interested in this?
Oh, well, I've always been a bit of a space geek, so I think space and exploration have really sparked my imagination, and I initially got involved with sort of asteroid impacts and mitigation through my PhD initially, and just sort of through my PhD research, and this is something that just sort of spun off it.
Well, it's good that you're interested, because there's not a lot of money going into this research,
no,
is there?
There isn't, and considering it's such a, if an asteroid was to impact the Earth, it would be such a global endeavor, and it would affect, the whole of humanity. The amount of funding is sort of low.
Do you think it's just a matter of time before another one hits us?
Definitely. I mean, there's the most sort of publicized case of a near-Earth asteroid is asteroid 99942 to Apophis, and that has what scientists and engineers consider a non-negligible impact risk of an Earth collision occurring in 2039. Now, that's subject to, complex orbital mechanics and dynamics, but it's still there, and it will be a good sort of eye-opener to the kind of community, both sort of academic, industry, and government, to the fact that just because you can't see asteroids, they're here, they are a presence in our solar system.
And we've been hit before, very famously.
Definitely, yeah.
Thank you very much, Allison. And good luck to you. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Allison Gibbings is a PhD student at the Advanced Space Concepts Laboratory at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland.